The lesson is from the book of Esther, chapter 5. In the previous chapter, Esther was about to undertake a very dangerous mission, and she had called for a three-day fast. Now it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace across from the king's house, while the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house, facing the entrance of the house. So it was, when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, that she found favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you, up to half the kingdom." So Esther answered, "If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, that he may do as Esther has said." So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. At the banquet of wine, the king said to Esther, "What is your petition? It shall be granted to you. What is your request? Up to half the kingdom? It shall be done." Then Esther answered and said, "My petition and request is this: if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." So Haman went out that day joyful and with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and called for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Then Haman told them of his great riches, the multitude of his children, everything in which the king had promoted him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. Moreover, Haman said, "Besides, Queen Esther invited no one but me to come with the king to the banquet that she prepared. And tomorrow I am again invited by her, along with the king. Yet all this avails me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows be made 50 cubits high, and in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet." And the thing pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. Here ends the lesson.
Thank you. The Book of Esther is an amazingly interesting. Surprised it hasn't yet been made into a film. I'm sure one day it will be. It's a great story for God's people. It's a great story in its own right. I said the last time I spoke on it that the theological high point of the book was in chapter 4, verse 13, where Mordecai, realizing that the Jews are about to be exterminated throughout the Persian Empire, sends a message to Esther that says, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Esther has been made queen of Persia that God might use her as his instrument to deliver the Jewish nation from its enemies. And so before we look at chapter 5, I'll just consider those last few words of chapter 4, verse 15. "Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, 'Go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise.'" Here is the first time that Esther shows initiative and leadership. So far, even though she's queen of Persia, she's been acting under the instructions of her uncle Mordecai. She's been doing the king's beckoning. But in verse 15, here we have someone who's showing the gift of initiative and leadership. She becomes queen in verse 15 of chapter 4. Of course, she's been wearing the crown now a number of years, but now she's started to act like a queen. Paul writes in Romans 12, verse 8, "The one who exhorts in his exhortation, the one who contributes in generosity, the one who leads with zeal, the one who does acts of mercy with cheerfulness." Paul is, of course, talking about spiritual gifts. Leadership and management is one of them. Notice also from chapter 4, verse 16, she seeks the support of all of God's people. She doesn't think, "Well, I'm queen, I can sort all this out myself." She asks all the Jews to gather together and to fast and support her. I used to visit an elderly lady who went to be with the Lord a few months ago. And when I used to go and visit her, she would always ask me what was going on here at the chapel and if I was going out preaching, where was I going? Because she said every week she held me up in prayer. And that was a great comfort to me. But it was also great to know that God's people were supporting me, as indeed I know many people do here. Notice, though, she asks the people to fast for her. Now, fast means to go without food, which is why our first meal of the day is called break fast. We've been fasting all night. We break that fast in the morning. And in the Bible, fasting is often a way of showing and demonstrating our earnestness towards God in prayer. Now, some Christians have a particular season where they fast. I don't particularly observe that. I'm not going to tell you whether I fast, because Jesus said in Matthew chapter 6, "But when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face, so that it will not be obvious to men that you are fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you." So if you go around telling everybody, "Oh, what a hard time you've had fasting," well, their adulation is all the reward you're going to get. However, fasting in the Bible is a principle whereby if you really want to show your earnestness towards God in prayer, then do without food, not just to lose weight, but to spend that time that would have been spent eating in prayer. Notice also that she leads by example. "My maids and I will fast likewise." Here is not the queen who commands others to do what she is not prepared to do herself. That is what you call scriptural leadership. I have a question for you, though. Does she pray? So she's about to do something that might result in the end of her life. She gathers all the Jews together, or asks them to gather together, to fast for her, but prayer is strangely missing. Now, I've mentioned this every time I've preached on Esther, but God is absent from the book in name. It's one of the few books in the Bible in which God is not mentioned. It's not because the writer was forgetful, he's actually making a point. And he's making the point here in verse 16 of chapter 4 by omitting the verb to pray. You see, the writer wants you to see that God is at work even when you can't see it. And part of his way of proving that is actually taking the word God out of the text. Because it's perfectly clear from this book, from beginning to end, that God is sovereign, God is in control, God is in charge. Kings come and kings go, and enemies come and enemies go, but God's plan is unfurling. Now, if Esther asked the Jews to pray, the inference would be implying that God, you know, you cannot but pray to God. And so the writer actually takes that word out to make the absence of God all the more obvious. It would spoil his effect. So almost certainly the Jews do pray. Esther is praying, but the writer wants to make a point to you and I by not mentioning it. She goes on, I will go to see the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. Now, why on earth would it be against the law to go and see the king? Because the Persians had a rule. No one comes into the presence of the king except by invitation. No, it's like me turning up at Buckingham Palace demanding entry to a garden party. I might wear the outfit, I might have polished my shoes, but if I'm not invited and on the list, I ain't being admitted. But the Persians took it a step further. They killed you if you turned up without an invitation, because the king was considered too important for you just to waltz up and expect an audience. And that role, that law applied to queens as much as anyone else. It raises a question, though. Shouldn't believers keep the law? If the law is you cannot enter the king's presence without invitation, then she shouldn't have gone. Well, sometime, we, as believers, we should keep the law of the land. We should keep the law of the country in which we live. But occasionally, the law of man and the law of God will conflict. And Peter says it's better to obey God than men. So Esther here is actually breaking the law. And she might pay for it with her own life. Though notice, she's willing to lose her life for others. Are you not reminded here of that verse in the 15th of John, where we're told, greater love have no man than this, than a man lay down his life for his friends. Esther doesn't even know half of the people she's attempting to save. Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. There's a role reversal here. So far, Esther's been doing what Mordecai commanded her. Now he is acknowledging the position that God has placed her in. We also see here, I think, an older generation giving way to a younger generation. It's not just queen and subject, it's young woman and older man. Sometimes when I go out, I see a number of churches and they're well led, they have a strong leadership. But there's no young men and women coming up. There's no one, kind of the new generation taking over. And that's okay at the moment, but one day, as those older men are called home, I think who then will take over? And maybe here Mordecai is acknowledging that Esther is part of a newer generation. Paul writes to Timothy, let no one despise you for your youth, but set the believers an example in speech, in conduct, in love, in faith, in purity. Esther, no doubt, is a young woman, but she does exactly what the apostle says. She lives by example. And so we come to chapter 5. So it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court. I said the last time I preached that archaeologists have found the palace in Susa, and it conforms to the description we have in the book of Esther. Evidently the king's inner court, he had a throne on a raised platform, and then there was like a wall or a screen, so he could see who was queuing up outside to see him. But they were not necessarily in his presence, because it says here in verse 1, she stands in her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, across from the king's house, while the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house, facing the entrance of the house. In other words, she was not in the presence of the king, but the king could see her waiting. Why does she do it on the third day? Because the Jews are fasting and the Jews are praying. There's no point barging into the king's presence when the Jews have barely begun to fast and pray. She waits for God to hear and acknowledge those prayers and that fasting. Interesting as well, why does she bother to put on the royal robes? If she has faith in God, why bother dressing as a queen? Why not just go in whatever she's wearing? Because after all, God will undertake for her. Is it a lack of trust? Does she not think the prayers will work? No. Our making preparation, our playing our parts, and trusting God, there is no conflict there. I know I've quoted it before, but trust God, but keep your powder dry. So it was when the king saw Queen Esther in the court. Now, in verse 2, in reality, we just carry on reading verse 2. But when this event actually happened, Esther is waiting for the king to see her. The king sees her, and it could go either way. Verse 2 is actually an incredibly dramatic moment in the book of Esther, because she's either going to live or die. What mood is the king in? He might say, I have not called that woman to come to me. And she'll automatically be killed. Notice also the contrast with Queen Vashti. Vashti refuses to come when she's called. Esther arrives, though she isn't. However, he goes her way. Why? Has he missed her? Does he like the look of her royal robes? Maybe she has a new hairstyle. No. It's Proverbs 21 verse 1 that gives us the answer. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. Like the rivers of water, he turns it wherever he wishes. Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, he has two names, thinks he is the most powerful man in the world. And he is. But there's a God in heaven who's more powerful than he. So the king looks at Esther, and what does he do? He held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter. A scepter is essentially a golden stick. Now, our queen has two. They only generally hold them when they are crowned. One is called the sovereign scepter with cross, which is a symbol of temporal power under God. And she has another scepter called the rod of equity and mercy. And a scepter was originally a weapon, is essentially a staff, by which a powerful king would perhaps once upon a time have used it as a weapon. And as time went on, they became more symbolic and more golden. But it's also an act of mercy. When you hold it out to someone and they touch it, what you're saying is, it's no longer a weapon. I offer you my staff to say that you will not be killed for entering my presence. You can come in to the palace. And she touches it to acknowledge it. The king then says to her, what do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you up to half the kingdom. Xerxes is not, in fact, offering her half the kingdom. This was simply hyperbole, an exaggerated statement to say, whatever you want, it's yours. He's not really on about dividing. You can have that half, and I will have this half. Now, a less spiritual person at this point might have asked him for jewels or clothing or more servants or this or that or the other. But Esther does something rather strange in verse 4. Esther answered, if it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him. Let's just recap what's going on here. Haman has become prime minister, effectively, and he is developing a plot to wipe out every single Jew in the Persian Empire. And the clock is ticking. And the king has authorized it. God has allowed Esther to enter into the presence of the king. Surely at this point, she would have said, Your Majesty, the Jews are about to die. I'm a Jew. Please save us. But she doesn't. From an outward worldly point of view, she's just blown her chance. She had one opportunity to become before the king. And what does she do? She invites him round for dinner. In fact, it's worse than that. She invites round for dinner also the very man who's trying to kill her family. What would Mordecai think when he finds out? What would the other Jews think? That so-called Jewish queen is having dinner with the enemy. Well, could it be that during those 3 days of fasting, the God, which the writer deliberately omits to describe, has given her wisdom from on high? Because in fact, what she does is what God wants her to do to save her people. The king is pleased with the idea. He says, "Bring Haman quickly, that he may do as Esther has said." So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. Notice also, she's probably spent the last 3 days preparing a banquet, though she herself is fasting. The king's alacrity in calling Haman is also noted. Some commentators suggest he was actually a despised noble. He wasn't necessarily respected by people in the palace. The fact here that there's now an unsolicited dinner invitation really is worthy of note, and so the king beckons him over straight away. Make the most of it. In verse 6, we get a description of the banquet. It says, "At the banquet of wine." I'm sure she prepared more than just glasses of wine for them, but wine was part of the banquet back then. And so the king says to her, "What is your petition? It shall be granted to you. What is your request? Up to half the kingdom. It shall be done." Ah, now you think, now this is Esther's opportunity to say, "I'm a Jew. The Jews are about to be annihilated in a few months' time. You must save me and my family." But in verse 7, we get another strange reply. Esther answered and said, "My petition and request is this. If I have found favour in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfil my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." Again, from an outward point of view, what is she doing? What is she playing at? Why doesn't she come straight out to the point, "I'm a Jew, you need to save me"? She doesn't. She invites Haman and the king to a second banquet which she is preparing. She's not stupid. She's being led by God, whom the writer deliberately does not mention. Psalm 16, verse 7 says, "I will bless the Lord who has counseled me. My mind instructs me in the night. I have set the Lord continually before me. Because he is at my right hand, I will not be shaken." It looks like Esther is doing nothing to help her people, but she will not be shaken. And she is counseled by the God of Israel. Now Haman is obviously delighted. He goes to a banquet with the queen. Now he's invited to a second banquet with the queen. Haman went out that day joyful and with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. We get a glimpse here into the heart of Haman. He is a man full of pride. His pride has in fact been hugely inflated. He's in favour now with both the king and the queen. But Mordecai has changed his mood. He hates this man so much. He loathes Mordecai so much that the joy and gladness he had upon leaving the palace dissipates straight away. Disappears. He expects people to fawn and show deference before him. And when they don't do that, he responds with hostility because he thinks he is someone great. In one respect, of course, he is. But here's a question. Why does Mordecai not tremble? If I thought that one of the most powerful men in the empire was coming towards me, and that he was wanting to kill me and all my people, I might get a little bit nervous. But Mordecai doesn't tremble. It's because of what I read at the end of chapter 4. God will deliver his people. That is guaranteed. God has said he will. He'll deliver the Jews through Esther, or he'll deliver through someone else, but either way. That, my friends, by the way, is faith. It's knowing the outcome, but not the means. It's knowing the end result, but not knowing the route taken to get there. It's knowing that God will do what he's promised, even when it looks like he isn't. You see, Mordecai's faith in God is greater than his fear of man. We're told in verse 10, nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. This is the first time in the book of Esther that we come across a good quality or characteristic of Haman. He manages to restrain himself. Well, it's not godly restraint. He's restraining himself because he's relishing the prospect of killing Mordecai and all the Jews at the set time. In fact, as he goes home, he comes up with a new plot to kill Mordecai. This is not restraint at all. Scripture warns us against those whose feet run to plot evil. He sent and called for his friends and his wife, Zeresh. Then Haman told them of his great riches, the multitude of his children, everything in which the king had promoted him, and how he had advanced him above all the officials and servants of the king. Notice he's comforting himself by boasting of all his achievements. Here is another glimpse into the heart of Haman. He gets all his friends together and reminds them of how rich he is. You ever come across people who do that? They like you to know how much they earn. If they thought that you earned more, they probably wouldn't tell you. He boasts about his promotion. He boasts about how he's better than everyone else. Notice, he's not just showing off about how well he's been promoted, but how he's been promoted higher than everyone else. The man who's full of pride gets pleasure from knowing that he's so-called better than other people. Haman's heart is wicked. The multitude of his children he boasts about. Remember, these are days in which the more children you have, the more blessed you're considered. Of course, he shows off about his children. Interesting as well, look, wouldn't his wife already know how many children he has? Chances are she was there when they came out. Why is he having to boast to her? You see, he doesn't care. His pride is so unabated. He even reminds her of how great he is because of all the children that she had. I'm sure Danny will agree that she did all the hard work. There's a bit of an echo chamber here. He's already boasting to his friends and his wife, people who already like him. He derives pleasure from these people falling and telling him how good he is and how wonderful he is. And, oh, wow, you're so rich and so wonderful. God doesn't do that. In Proverbs 27, verse 2, we're advised, let another praise you and not your own mouth, a stranger and not your own lips. Moreover, Haman said, besides, Queen Esther invited no one but me. Isn't he good? No one but him. In with the king to the banquet that she prepared. And tomorrow I am again invited by her along with the king. His final boast. Well, let me read once again from the book of Proverbs. Do not boast about tomorrow. You do not know what a day may bring forth. If Haman knew what the morrow held, not only would he not have boasted about it, he'd have got on his horse and he'd have gone away. Do not boast about tomorrow. We don't know what the day will bring forth. In verse 13, though, we get to the real pit of his heart. Yet all this avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Again, this man derives his happiness from others. Knowing that he's richer than you makes him happy. Knowing that he has more children than you makes him happy. Knowing that he's invited to a party that you're not makes him happy. Knowing that there's someone out there that doesn't fawn and crawl makes him unhappy. Friends, let me tell you. If your happiness is based upon having more things than other people, you're a fool. Because one day you'll lose all of it. But if you can base your happiness and your joy upon something or someone that changeth not, if your boasting is in Christ and no one else, let me tell you, you'll not be put to shame. This man can only be happy if the one person who doesn't respect him is removed. Yet all this avails me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him. Now Zeresh is an interesting character. Her name means golden. She's not the best of wives, because here she's encouraging him to do evil. And in the next chapter, which I'll consider this evening, she kind of blames him for not being wiser. He took her advice. Let a gallows be made, 50 cubits high, and in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet. 50 cubits, what does that mean? 8 stories or 75 feet? Rather high. That's a high gallows. Now, in order for it to be constructed one evening, some commentators have suggested, in fact, it was probably placed on top of a building or an existing platform, because it's an awful lot of woodwork for one night's work. It's also worth considering the word gallows. When I think of gallows, I think it's an object from which someone might hang by the neck. In fact, the Persians were rather fond of impaling people. It may have been an actual stake which you're kind of hanging from, as it were. Either way, it's an unpleasant, grisly end for his enemy. Notice also that wicked Haman takes wicked advice from his wicked wife and his wicked friends. You take advice from wicked people, you'll do wicked things. But if you base your life and the way you live on that good book, which doesn't tell you what you want to hear, you'll do right. Now, it's significant here that he takes the advice of his wife, because later on, his family end up suffering as a result. And that's partly because his family were egging the man on. He's already invented one evil plan to wipe out all the Jews, but he's not content with that. Have you noticed? Mordecai is already going to die within the year, but he's not content. See, that's what sin does. It grows. It multiplies. It has an insatiable appetite to swell. He's already a murderer, planning to be a murderer, but he wants to bring it forward and kill one man in particular. Proverbs chapter 2 says, it warns us against those who delight in doing evil and rejoice in the perversity of evil. This man, his wife and their friends are rejoicing in their evil and warped plan. We're told the thing pleased Haman. What's pleasing him? Killing a man who's done nothing wrong. His crime is not to bow and scrape and fawn and tremble before the mighty Haman. I ask you. Now, of course, some of you know how the book ends. Some of you may have read ahead. But I ask you, is Mordecai's position and the whole Jewish nation's position better at the end of the chapter than it was at the beginning? No, it's not. In fact, Mordecai's position is worse. At the beginning of the chapter, he had until the end of the year. Now he has until the end of the night to live. Where's God? Where's God's deliverance? We know that Mordecai has spies in the Persian court. He finds out what's going on. It might be that if he found out what was going on, I don't think he did, but if he did, he might then say, God, where are you? But remember this, says the book of Esther. God will deliver and God will save, even when he appears to be absent. Even when you cannot see him, he's working in the background. Even when your situation gets worse, his providential, sovereign plan will unfold, come what may. And this evening, we'll look at the final chapter.